Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. Now, Michael, this week is the 10-year anniversary of The Decision, LeBron James's nationally televised special in 2010, where he picked the Miami Heat and the pleasures of South Beach over returning to dreary Cleveland, Ohio to play with the Cavaliers. In hindsight, you know, probably not the most controversial and illogical decision, but at the time, it was obviously a very, very big deal. He wound up undoing a lot of the damage by going home in 2014, as we know, winning the title in 2016, as everybody remembers. But Michael, I wanted to use The Decision's 10th anniversary as a jumping off point for a discussion of the 10 worst NBA decisions of the past decade. How does that sound?
This is, I don't think I've ever been more excited to do an episode with you, Ben.
Yeah, this is sort of like the Mount Rushmore of mistakes or something like that. I don't know exactly what we're going to call it, but we're going to dig into that in a minute. Before we do, what do you remember about The Decision, Michael? Where were you? How did you watch it? What was your initial reaction? Obviously, I alluded to some of the controversy and the, you know, the burned jerseys and the accusations of treason, and he's turning his back on Ohio, and you know, he's not going to do it like Jordan did it, all that kind of stuff. Where did you come down that summer of 2010?
So I was, this was probably, thinking back, the peak of my own personal NBA fandom, just loving the NBA as someone who's not covering it on a professional level. So I was just out of college. I did not have a girlfriend. I was reeling from the 2010 finals, which had just occurred a couple weeks prior. I was convinced
Michael, what happened in those finals? I forget.
We don't need to go over it. I was convinced that the Celtics were the best team, that they got robbed because Kendrick Perkins tore his ACL in game six. But again, we do not need to rehash those events. And I was just obsessed with Boston getting back to the finals in 2011 and potentially going up against the Lakers again, which is what I wanted to see and what I thought would happen. And then,
so when he says, take my talents to South Beach, your first thought is, oh God, we're not getting back to the finals in 2011?
Oh, not at all. No, I was extremely confident in Boston still at that point. And a part of that might have just been pure delusion and me just convincing myself that the Celtics were better and that they had experience and that their years kind of battling together would allow them to have better chemistry and all that junk. But I remember I was just watching it. I was living in my parents' basement at the time, literally blogging from my parents' basement. And I just remember watching it on this like boxy standard definition television with a good friend of mine. And we were just like really excited. We you know, the Eastern Conference had been and kind of was still going to be for the next umpteen years just really garbage. And so to have this really exciting team, to have another potential budding rivalry, because I was sick of watching the Celtics play the Cavs and play teams like the Magic. Just like there wasn't a lot of real great competition. The Pistons era was just dying. So I was excited. And I love villains. And this team was giving me just a lot of fuel. And I hate
so that. it was like the satisfying team that you wanted to overcome. Like Boston's 2011 title would be so magical because you had to go through the Heatles. Oh, interesting.
Exactly. So yeah, it's like an us against the world type of thing, which is really easy to conjure when you're from Boston. So that's where my head was at for sure.
I think that's one of their biggest legacies, though, the Heatles, of just being a team that was either loved or hated, right? And mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, really hated, and they were just such an easy target. You know, eventually, I think they won over some of the casual fans, you know, during the long winning streak or when they put the two titles together. But especially at the start, you know, they just leaned so heavily into, like, the warm weather climate, the glitz and glamour. They're Hollywood as hell, as Joakim Noah said, you know, the preseason celebration where they're saying they're going to win 8 titles. I mean, all of it was just like, if you weren't a fan of one of those players individually, or you weren't living in the 305, if you weren't personally Pitbull or Rick Ross, all of it was just like very, very off-putting, but also magnetizing in a way because you wanted to watch them, you know, watch them fail. I remember just watching it at home, you know, typing along, tweeting along, in real time with basically what was then a much smaller NBA Twitter community. I remember it blew my mind. I didn't really see it coming. I guess I just assumed that he would do whatever Jordan had done, which is just stay home and tough it out. And, you know, this idea that you put three stars together back then, it wasn't like it was the first big three of all time, but, you know, even Boston's big three, which they had put together, and some of the other, you know, even the Lakers, you know, where you're using like Lamar Odom maybe as the third, it just didn't stack up to this idea of three all-NBA level talents in their mid-20s, you know, gold medalists, all that kind of stuff. It just seemed scary and mind-blowing. And so I guess to me, I was in the camp of, these guys are just going to own the NBA for 5 years, and this is going to probably not be very entertaining by the end of it. You know, I was a little bit resigned to their dominance. I remember when they came through Portland the first couple of times, it was just like, oh my God, especially because LeBron was really hitting that level where, like, when he hit the open court, you could just forget about it, and people would just, like, jump out of his way, and it was almost like a fear factor, an intimidation factor. And so they felt, you know, somewhat inevitable. But I will say their losses were pretty sweet to watch, man. Like that 2011 finals was the first finals I covered. It was so rich in stories. And then the 2014 finals where they just got smoked off the court and, you know, basically self-combusted without the types of injuries that we really saw for, you know, Golden State in 2019 where, you know, they kind of go out in a blaze of glory as well. I mean, both of those are very, very memorable finals. Some of the most memorable series of the entire decade, kind of for all the wrong reasons, though.
Yeah, the 2011 finals in particular, I remember having a bunch of conversations with people just, I don't know, playing pickup basketball, asking people who they thought was going to win. And the narrative was like, the Mavericks have no chance because they're a jump shooting team, and the Miami Heat are, you know, loaded with guys, most notably Dwayne Wade and LeBron James, who can just kind of burrow their way to the free throw line whenever they want and get to the basket. And that was still the predominant way to look at basketball. So that was really a fascinating kind of narrative that emerged before that series took place. And then after it, what we saw was LeBron really understanding the need to develop his weaknesses. I mean, he needed to get a post game. He needed to get a more dependable outside shot. And obviously the fire of the finals was not something that he could handle mentally at that point. So, I mean, that series alone is just like so fascinating, even 10 years later. But real quick, like that Miami Heat team, when they first were constructed, I think the big differentiator between them and those other big threes was obviously that it felt like this was the first time a player or players had engineered their own destiny and their own free agent movement in a way that those other ones were created more by the front offices and ownership groups and that sort of thing. And this was the first time where it was like the players being like, it doesn't really matter where we end up, we're just going to play together. And I think that really turned a lot of people off, and it was jarring at the time. And now it's just, that's the NBA today. That's just the world that we live in.
Yeah, there's no question. It's a great point to make. The start of the player empowerment era. I wrote about this for my newsletter this week, and I was kind of going back through like all of the players who sort of, you know, made their own decisions in the wake of the decision. And it's an incredibly long list. And this is not even fully comprehensive, but you had Carmelo Anthony, Chris Paul, Darren Williams, Dwight Howard, Kevin Durant, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, all in the next basically 8 years, move from smaller market franchises to greener pastures, all benefiting from the cover of LeBron being the one who kind of went first and said, you know what, I'm going to be this guy who shakes off, you know, the questions about treason and just kind of does what's in my own personal best interest. The other fascinating thing about their team up was that both he and Wade were legitimate alphas, right? And Chris Bosh clearly became, you know, the number three guy like from the start. Mm-hmm. He was an alpha in Toronto as well, just kind of in a different way. But, you know, we didn't see a lot of there's always that pecking order, right? And eventually it emerged in Miami, but that was sort of the major question that a lot of people had, the doubters had in 2010, of like, you know, it's only, you know, only one person can lead this team, only one person can have the ball. Can these guys play together? And to their credit, they really showed that they could. It always bothered me, Michael, even back in 2010, when people were trying to tell free agents where they should go or where they shouldn't go. I'm glad that we've progressed here over the last 10 years to what I think is a healthier place as an NBA community, where I think people just accept that these guys are going to, you know, dictate and flex their muscles in these situations. Because, I mean, ultimately, like, you know, it's not a perfect comparison, but who would want to be stuck with the same organization for 10, 12 years of their careers, kind of be forced there or kind of guilt tripped into staying with that, you know, same spot if people weren't functioning on a championship level or they weren't able to achieve their goals? I mean, ultimately, the people who were, I guess, blaming LeBron for not wanting to stay in Cleveland, they always bother me. And I just think that we have certainly evolved here over the last 10 decades in terms of how we interpret those types of moves.
I think so. I think the NBA has certainly evolved in that it changed several rules that allowed it. It made it easier for players to retain their stars and pay them more money, which is a direct byproduct of the decision. And then, I mean, but like fundamentally, I still think that when a player leaves a small market, that those fans still to this day feel like really torched, and they
jilted.
Feel really upset, yeah, towards whoever. I mean, we're still, you know, it's not as dramatic as it was, but guys are still like burning jerseys and being childish like that. So,
well, the thing is though, like, it's one thing if someone, like one person is burning a jersey or scattered jerseys are being burned. I mean, Twitter does an amazing job right now of elevating the lunatics out there. I got to give that platform credit. But I think what's different is when LeBron left Cleveland, and part of it is because he's such a big star, right? But when he goes back for that first game, I mean, the visceral anger and like just, you know, I don't want to call it hate, but it kind of was trending that direction, was so, you know, so obvious, so clear for people to see on television. And it was like the entire building, you know, it's how everyone felt, that collective felt. And, you know, certainly he was pilloried on social media by lots of, you know, writers, columnists, television talking heads. I think now the conversation has moved towards, okay, are these guys making good decisions or bad decisions for their careers? Are they going to be set up to win titles? Is this going to be a good off-court branding move? As opposed to just like saying, you know, you're letting a city down, right? You're a bad person because you're not trying to carry the weight of a specific city. I just think that the nature and the tenor of the conversation has shifted a little bit.
For sure. And I mean, I went back and read a bunch of articles from 2011 and that summer from, I guess it was the summer of 2010, technically. And the word selfish was used so much to describe LeBron James. And I think if you were
And Dan Gilbert called him a coward, right?
Yeah. I mean. Well, yeah. That was a whole different can of worms. But I think if you were to read columns today from, say, you know, Kevin Durant's decision to leave Golden State, like the word selfish, I would be, I can't guarantee this, but I don't think that was written by anyone describing the motivations for him choosing to leave Golden State for that reason. So I think that just the shift in the attitude is really interesting, and it's kind of a breath of fresh air because that's what we need. We don't like, I thought that the selfishness, that kind of that narrative angle was really gross even when it was happening in real time. And so it's good that kind of most people have evolved.
Well, and there was a book about LeBron that basically called him a prostitute in the title, you know?
And I was just thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah, it got really dark, man. I'm telling, like, I don't think we've made that much progress as an American society or as a global society in the last 10 years. Arguably, we've descended backwards given that we're largely locked and confined inside our own apartments at this point of life. But I do think that we've become slightly more enlightened in terms of how we talk about athletes. Final quick point on this. Zach Lowe made it last week on his podcast about the decision. I just want to reiterate it. It was an economic boon for the league, for the players, and also for the media. The league salary cap has almost doubled in the last 10 years. LeBron's salary has almost tripled in the last 10 years. And when you're looking at NBA media coverage in terms of how many people have jobs, how major national outlets staffed these things, it was just night and day after that decision. You're seeing, you know, like super teams of writers being thrown down in Miami to cover them. Same thing happens when Golden State forms. Same thing happens when LeBron goes to Los Angeles. It was a big deal for the media members and for me specifically. My first national job was at CBS Sports months after LeBron, you know, made his decision. The first finals I covered were those 2011 finals. So I just think that it's a major turning point in every aspect of the storytelling of the NBA.
Humongous move by LeBron. Humongously influential, and it basically dictated the next decade of NBA decision making.
My last LeBron question for you, quick rapid fire. Mm-hmm. Were the Heat a disappointment? Yes or no?
No, not at all. I mean, I think one of the worst things LeBron ever did, and people will point to the actual decision as being terrible, and, you know, it wasn't the greatest move ever to go on national television, even though the funds were going to charity, to go on national television.
I mean, I thought it was bad when Gordon Hayward dragged out his decision for 7 hours and wrote 3,000 words, you know, thanks Utah, as he's leaving them.
Yeah.
But LeBron really buried the lead on that TV show, you know, and that bothers me. You got to come out of the gate strong, LeBron. Come on.
Yeah, and Gordon Hayward doing it on July 4th nonetheless, and that hitting the Players Tribune right before fireworks were about to go off. I remember where I was there, not too happy. But... yeah, so I think like the thing that it's not like it's overshadowed at all, but when he does the I don't even know what to call it, like I'm gonna call it a parade, but it wasn't a parade, it was like an assembly party, whatever gathering down in Miami where they unveil the jerseys with Wade and Bosch, and he says not one, not two, not three. I think that moment really, it set an impossible standard and an impossibly high bar that he had to basically try to live up to from that point forward. So when you eliminate that and then you just look at what they actually did, which was go to four straight finals, win two in a row, I just think like winning one championship is so, so difficult regardless. And to go to four straight, even though the East was not the strongest, I mean, they survived and endured some serious injuries to Chris Bosh. I mean, those Celtics teams weren't dead at that point. They were still pretty competitive. And then beating, you know, the young Oklahoma City Thunder that was really talented. And they, I think they dropped game one of that series as well. So, I think that they were successful. Winning two out of four, going to four straight finals, that's not easy to do.
I think that they were not a disappointment in terms of the overall body of work. If you're saying off-court influence, changing the game, being the center of attention, elevating LeBron's personal narrative, doing something that no one else had done before, flipping the power dynamics towards the superstars, as you described, away from the organizations in front offices, they exceeded expectations on mm-hmm. those levels. If you're saying strictly basketball, to me, they were a disappointment, man. If we can rewind and say you have LeBron at 25, Dwayne Wade in their mid-20s, Chris Bosh in his mid-20s, and you've got Miami to lure, you know, as a city, as a tax-free haven, to lure your supporting cast. I mean, I was expecting like over under 3.5 titles when they got together. Now, I wasn't doing not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, not seven like LeBron. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason why I view them as disappointments, because they promised eight. Like, they went on stage and told us it was going to be eight. All right, well, you've got a 10-year runway. Show me what you can do with it. The fact that it ended within 4 years, the fact that it fizzled out so dramatically in 2014, they just got flat out beat by two teams in 2011 and 2014 that were better teams, emphasis on teams, than the Heat's big three in cast. I just think I expected more from them. Now, I'm not saying, oh, yeah, like they're a disappointment, like, you know, they're a bust. I'm not saying that. I just think, like, four finals appearances coming through the Eastern Conference is impressive. It's not that incredible. Try to do it in the West, see what happens. And two titles, it was pretty close to one title, right? I mean, it was one shot away from one title. And I do think if Ray Allen doesn't hit that shot, they're viewed in a totally different light, and a lot of this stuff looks different. So kudos to him for doing it. I'm not trying to bag on them. I also think part of the disappointment factor is they're not even the team of the decade. You know, the Golden State Warriors came along right after them and basically beat them at their own game, right? They have four stars instead mm-hmm. of three stars. They win three titles instead of two titles. They go to five finals instead of four finals. They change the way the game is actually played, turning it into a three-point game as opposed to, like, you know, the Heat style of play dominating the league for years forward. I just think that the Warriors wound up being more influential on the court specifically. So maybe that helps provide some context. You sound a little shocked when I said disappointment.
I was. I mean, that's harsh, Ben. Come on.
I keep it real, especially during the quarantine, yeah. Michael. I got to keep it real.
I mean, well, when you say they were saved by the Ray Allen shot, yes, I agree. Ridiculous play that, you know, if they replay that 100 times, probably doesn't happen 99 of them. But, like, they also probably should have won that Mavericks series. And, like, there were a few moments in that series.
Totally disagree.
Okay.
Well, it's all on LeBron. That one was on him, man. If he showed up to play, they should have won that series. He did not show up for at least half of that series. And there's a reason why he was hiding in his house for like a month or two after that went down. You know, like, that would have stung. I can't imagine how painful that would have been, given all the buildup to that series for him. I think they were rightfully on the wrong side of that one, in my opinion.
Okay, well, I mean, I forget what game it was. I think it was game three, maybe, where they had the 15-point lead that they blew. Like, there was just some stuff that, you know, like, could have gone another way, and I think that they were still superior in terms of talent, and it's not like they were blown out in a sweep or anything like that, so. And, like, I think everything kind of balances itself out, and winning two out of four is still super impressive, and you are an incredibly large hater right now for thinking that that is not. Also, real quick, like, the Golden State Warriors are probably the team of the decade, and I think that that's a little more debatable than you're letting on. I don't think that they would have ever existed if it weren't for the Miami Heat, and I don't think that Kevin Durant would have. I don't think he would have had the stones to go to the Golden State Warriors if LeBron stayed in Cleveland his whole career.
I agree 1,000%. I put that in my newsletter. You know, Golden State beat Miami had its own game, but they did so playing by the rules that LeBron set. You know, there's just kind of no way around that. All right, this is the trick with the Heat, though, Michael. They'll suck you in, and you could yell about the Heat for an hour and a half. I mean, it's like, I mean, they really made life easy on Talking Heads for about four straight years there, and we're still reaping the benefits today. Let's shift gears, though. I want to know the worst decisions, okay? We can agree, even if they were a disappointment, we can't agree on if they're a disappointment or not, right? But we can both agree it was a good decision for LeBron. It paid off. He got his rings. He became much more famous. He was able to go back to Cleveland and continue on with his career. The decision worked out very well, even if the TV show wasn't executed that well. I want to know about some NBA decisions that did not pan out, that blew up in people's faces, maybe that cost people jobs. I want the worst of the worst, Michael. So I tasked you with being the foundational pillar of this list. Give me your favorite worst decision. This is not ranked necessarily. I just want to know your favorite worst decision of the last 10 years.
Okay, so now I'm going to put on my hater hat. My favorite worst decision, 2017, the Sixers trade the third pick in the draft along with a future first round pick that belonged to the Sacramento Kings and was top one protected and eventually became Romeo Langford for Boston's number one overall pick. And that player was basically Markelle Fultz for Jason Tatum. It was a colossal screw-up by the Philadelphia 76ers. It was a colossal screw-up. You know, we didn't know that Fultz would be, you know, he's turned out to be, I think, a serviceable, interesting point guard going forward who can still have a very productive career, but...
Well, way too charitable. You're being really nice to the guy, but continue.
But for the Sixers, we know the story was written, has been written already in terms of his legacy there. And, you know, he's no longer there. He's at the Orlando Magic. So I just think that this was just a colossal screw-up. And in the moment, even not knowing that Tatum would be better, a lot better than Markelle Fultz, giving up a future first that was eventually it was like the 15th or 14th pick, I believe, but at the time it was projected to be a lot higher than that because it belonged to the Sacramento Kings. So like giving that up, a humongously valuable chip, and giving up Tatum, who we'll just assume that they would have taken Tatum at three. A Tatum, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid trio just dominates the NBA for the foreseeable future, and you can't tell me different. And so even...
Michael, do you have a tattoo on your body that says, Philly doubted my son? I mean, is that really what this boils down to?
It's
just all of it... All of it's just about the misanalysis on Tatum. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
What was a worse trade involving the Celtics? The Tatum trade or the Nets blockbuster where, you know, they put themselves in the hole for like five straight years by taking on KG and giving up all those draft picks and pick swaps and all that stuff? Like, which one was worse?
Oh, it's, I mean, the Nets trade is all-time catastrophe. And, I mean...
Because that was my number one for the decade. It's great that we're doing a podcast where I pretend to make fun of the Celtics on every episode, and the Celtics won the two biggest ones on our list. Fantastic. Great. Great for me.
Yeah, and I'm not really done. Just I want to get more specific and dig into this. So please oblige me for another couple minutes here, Ben, but... So they take the Celtics get Jason Tatum, they get the pick, and then that year, the two teams, the Sixers and the Celtics, face off in the second round. And I just want to read off some of Jason Tatum's stats in that playoff series, which the Celtics won in five games. He's a 19-year-old rookie. He averaged 23.6 points on 53% shooting, 7.5 free throw attempts per game. He was plus 34 in a series where three games were decided by five or fewer points. It's like, I don't really know where to go from there. And that was obviously his rookie season. They lose in seven in the conference finals. And Tatum is an all-star a couple of years later. And, you know, he has MVP aspirations that are legitimate. So for the Sixers, it's like you're still in decent shape. You still have Embiid. You still have Simmons. You have Tobias Harris. You have, Al Horford. And you're an intriguing team that a lot of people thought could have gone to the finals this season, and maybe you will go to the finals this year. We don't know. But the future, the alternative future where you take Tatum and you still have that other pick is just, it's really scary to think about what the Sixers could have been relative to what they are and where they are right now.
For sure. Let me just pour a little bit more salt in the wound. I mean, you also have to keep in mind they only got 33 games total out of Markelle Fultz. So whatever he becomes in Orlando is now irrelevant because they already gave up on him. They didn't have the stomach to see the development project through. So that further just buries that decision. Also, you can do the transitive property and say, well, like, what did they trade Fultz for? If they, you know, like if they gave up Tatum to get Fultz, what did they wind up getting for Fultz? That trade in 2019 was Jonathan Simmons, a second-round pick, and a top 20 protected first-round pick. So, Michael, let me put it to you. If Orlando had offered Jonathan Simmons a 2019 second-round pick and a top 20 first-round pick for Tatum in 2019, would you have said yes or no?
I would have to turn that one down, I think. That would be my professional advice.
And on top of that, Philly gave up the extra first-round pick, as we keep mentioning. So, yeah, that was a pretty terrible decision. It's kind of amazing that that team hasn't exploded yet, given all these mistakes that they've kind of made along the way. But that certainly is one, you know, very, very near the top of the list. All right, what other worst decisions do you have?
So, I mean, next up, I just want to quickly skim over the summer of 2016 with you. And we don't need to go deep on all these contracts, but
oh yeah, there's a top 10 of bad decisions on overpays from that summer alone, right? Because that's the cap spike summer where the new TV money kicks in. The Warriors are able to get KD, which everybody gets blinded by, and then all over the league, GMs were making it rain for the Jan Mahinmis of the world.
Most of these GMs are currently out of a job for a good reason. So. Evan Turner, $70 million after playing in Boston as basically their backup point guard and making $3 million a year. Solomon Hill to the Pelicans for $52 million after he failed to average 5 points per game in his last season with the Indiana Pacers. Harrison Barnes, who's obviously a key player on that Golden State team, but of course was also kind of viewed as symbolically the reason that they lost. And he gets $94 million from the Dallas Mavericks.
That summer when they went from Harrison Barnes to Kevin Durant, I think I compared it a tricycle to a Ferrari. So that's just the context you need, that Mark Cuban paid max money basically for a tricycle.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. My favorite just craptacular signing was actually two signings by the Los Angeles Lakers. They gave a combined $136 million to Luol Deng and Timofey Mozgov, and neither would have a significant or meaningful play, let alone moment, let alone memory in a Lakers jersey. My
favorite memory about that is they happened right at the start of free agency with Mozgov.
Yeah, those are the first two announced, yeah.
And so I was always grading these deals in real time, and you never want to come straight out of the gate with an F because, like, it could always get worse, right? That's what you think. And I think I gave the Mozgov one maybe like a C minus or a D. I was like unusually charitable because I was thinking, well, like, you know, this is going to be a crazy summer. We all know the cap spike. There's going to be just insane numbers out there and everything else. I remember getting so much hate from my fellow like dork bloggers of the world. I remember Danny LaRue just needling me. He's like, what are you talking about? This is a horrible deal. So other people realized quite how bad that one was before I did.
Yeah, it was atrocious. And then my other favorite terrible move was Jan Mahinmi, a center, getting paid $64 million by the Washington Wizards, who already had Marcin Gortat, a center. So that one just, and this was like as the league was, we knew about small ball, like the death lineup was already a thing. So to make that move was just like, I don't really know what was going on there. And there has been no explanation given to me since that makes any sense. So those were just like my favorites that I wrote down, that just like really, really bad decisions across the board.
Well, the one about the changing NBA, it's a great point. I want to underscore it with one of my favorite worst decisions of the decade. It's actually from that same summer, and it lines up very similar with what you're saying about, you know, how are you not reading the tea leaves? How do you not see where the NBA is going? And there was just a lag factor. Some teams got it. The smart teams got it quickly, and they wanted to play copycat with the Warriors. And the less smart teams took 2 or 3 years to kind of figure out, oh, yeah, like, we're not even going to be able to play, you know, centers who are just strictly shot-blocking guys if they can't move, they can't shoot, and they can't do anything else, right? On my list for the worst decisions has to be the 2016 NBA draft by the Phoenix Suns. To take Dragon Bender at 4 and then get Marquese Chriss at 8, where those guys basically give you nothing. So it's not just you're messing up one draft pick, right? Everybody blows a draft pick. It happens. But to mess up 2 in the top 8 in the same year, and look, if there was like no good players below them, right, I wouldn't be making quite as much fun of them, but they could have had Jamal Murray, right? Mm-hmm. They could have had DeMontis Sabonis. They could have had even a Malik Beasley. They could have had a Caris LeVert. Maybe that's not the best pick with his injuries and stuff along the way. They could have had the crown jewel, Pascal Siakam. I mean, can you imagine Phoenix if they had Jamal Murray and Pascal Siakam instead of Dragon Bender and Marquese Chriss? And what killed me about those moves is, like, both Bender and Chriss didn't have a position. There was major question marks about both of them. It almost seemed like they took both of them just knowing that one would flame out and hoping that the other one wouldn't, right? They're kind of positionally conflicting. And it was just like the ultimate, like, swing for the fences twice draft, praying someone's going to pan out. And it was exactly the wrong situation to do it in because they didn't have enough structure. They didn't have enough ball handling, playmaking, and all that kind of stuff. They had major other needs on that roster. And then they wind up, like, not very long after that, needing to take DeAndre Ayton anyways because they never found their answer for the future in the middle. So to me, for very similar reasons as what you're describing about some of those centers getting paid in free agency, we have to put the Suns' 2016 draft on this list.
That's a great call. Comically atrocious decision-making right there across the board, even though I think, if I recall correctly, I wanted the Celtics to take Dragon Bender instead of Jaylen Brown, which is like my all-time faux pas. I hate admitting it, but I'm an honest person, so I'm going to say it out loud on the pod. But yeah, that would have been a catastrophic decision.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been great. No. But at the same time, Dragon Bender could probably play in the NBA if he got drafted to Boston. So that's part of the deal, too. Like, unfortunately, some of these teams, it's like your bad decisions are compounded by your lack of culture and developmental, you know, petri dish and everything else. I think if you put Jaylen Brown in Phoenix, his career might go a little bit differently than it has so far. You know, it's just kind of the breaks that you get, you know, between the haves and the have-nots in the NBA. All right, give me some more of your worst decisions.
Okay, Ben. This one is a little, I think it's overlooked, happened a while ago. And, you know, if you look at kind of the legacy of it and its tale, I think the NBA would just be so different today if it never happened. But the Los Angeles Clippers in 2011 trading Baron Davis and an unprotected first-round pick to the Cleveland Cavaliers for Mo Williams and Jamario Moon. That unprotected first-round pick became Kyrie Irving for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And at the time, the Clippers were 21-37 when they made this deal. They had Blake Griffin, they had Eric Bledsoe, they had Eric Gordon, they had DeAndre Jordan. They were young, they were up and coming. To give up an unprotected first-round pick when you're a bad team and you're rebuilding to get Mo Williams, someone who you would eventually jettison in a four-team trade to get Lamar Odom, it's like that one we don't talk about enough. And I think a big reason why is because the Clippers just like immediately got Chris Paul and everything was fine, and they were able to kind of recast themselves and become what they are today 9 years later, which is arguably the best team in the NBA with two superstars. But imagine them winning the lottery here They get Kyrie to go with Blake Griffin, you know, Eric Bledsoe, Eric Gordon, all those names that I mentioned before, plus the flexibility that comes moving forward with those pieces as trade assets. I just think, like, that trade, that's a really, really bad, bad, bad decision by the Clippers.
Well, sometimes not having fans works to your benefit, you know, like scaring your entire fan base away mm-hmm. with like 20 years of ineptitude can actually come back to help you, because had, like, say, the Sixers done that exact same trade, right? Like, what would be the Twitter volume of anger around it, you know, trading the unprotected number one compared to what the Twitter volume was for the Clippers at that time? I think it's a fair comparison to make. You're right. They did, you know, kind of build themselves out of the sand trap very well. Let me ask you, was that the worst trade involving Kyrie Irving, though? I mean, don't forget, 2017, Cleveland sends Kyrie Irving to Boston for Jay Crowder and an injured Isaiah Thomas, Zizek, a first-round pick mm-hmm. that wound up being Colin Sexton, and then a second-round pick.
No,
obviously. At the time, let me just say this. At the time, I predicted, like, a month before that trade happened, those exact terms, minus Zizek. I thought it made sense if Isaiah was healthy as a stopgap, you know, just trying to give LeBron an extra wing defender and another playmaker and kind of let him do his thing before, you know, he rides off into the sunset to L.A. In hindsight, though, if you're saying, are you just trying to do the best possible trade for the organization, given where Kyrie's value was at that point of his career and, you know, far fewer red flags about his personality than exist today, they probably should have done it better than that, right?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to the Cavs, you have, obviously, you don't know how bad Isaiah Thomas's hip is, and he's coming off one of the 10 best offensive seasons in NBA history. Granted, he needs a payday. And you also don't know exactly where that Nets pick that the Celtics included is going to land. So I think it was 8 overall, and they get Colin Sexton. So they don't really get what they probably hoped they would, which is, I mean, the Nets were terrible for years, and the Celtics, you know, they got the first overall pick from that bounty. They got the 3rd overall pick with Jaylen. So they were probably thinking that pick was going to be a little bit higher, and then the Nets kind of exceeded, I guess, their own internal expectations. So, I mean, I'm trying to, like, defend this, and I struggle to, because you're also ostensibly trying, I would imagine, even though LeBron is putting out feelers that he's leaving, you're trying to keep the guy around. That should be the main motivation of your organization.
Sure.
So you're not doing that by trading away Kyrie, who's helped you win a title, and getting back pieces that just don't work, and then you have to make a midseason trade to bring in Jordan Clarkson and Larry Nance, and it's just like a total catastrophe and mess.
Look, we're going to run the whole gamut here, Michael, of bad decisions, some that were logical when they were made, some that were illogical when they were made. I definitely think that if you have a sound defense for what you did and it just blew up in your face, you probably don't get crushed by history mm-hmm. quite as much as you do if you're just drafting Dragan Bender and Marquise Chris, right? And just like, we're throwing darts at the board, see what happens. But I do think, like, when you look back on how little value they extracted, like, I think it's fair to Monday Morning Quarterback that one. And let me be clear, I was all in with that trade idea. I thought it was a good idea. And actually, you know, this is embarrassing to admit, but I was actually could see Brooklyn's logic on the Paul Pierce Kevin Garnett trade. I was like, well, they got to be relevant. They're moving to a building. They got to do something big and splashy. They got the money to spend it. You know, those future picks aren't going to be that great because they're going to be a good team.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, that was obviously terrible logic, as it turned out, in part because Deron Williams just completely fell off a cliff as a player. We can say a decision is bad, even if we agreed with it at the beginning, just based on how it panned out. It's probably a little bit more intellectually honest to admit when you got it wrong, just like the team did. And I'm trying to do that here at various points, but the Kyrie one, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to get 50 games of a broken down Isaiah Thomas. Not even that. Crowder, who didn't look nearly as good after he left Boston, and then Colin Sexton, where that's just a tough watch every night. That's pretty rough.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And what's really funny about this trade is that if you were to ask just like casual Celtics fans or also diehard Celtics fans who don't watch the rest of the NBA about this trade, they would say that the Celtics, it was the worst trade in Celtics history, because that is how much distaste they have for Kyrie Irving, which is pretty funny.
Everybody lost. Perfect.
Exactly. Real quick before I move on to my next horrible decision from the last 10 years, I just want to mention two quick funny tidbits from that Baron Davis Clippers trade. Chris Kaman, he was in the middle of his eighth year in the NBA, and he made the All-Star team the previous season. After this trade was announced, he told reporters that he did not know that players could get traded in the middle of the season. Which is just, I was laughing to myself when I read that. And then there's this great...
He probably came to find that out on multiple occasions, didn't he? I feel like he was pretty well-traveled, right?
Yeah, he's... Well, ironically, the next year, I think he was traded to the Hornets in the Chris Paul trade. But as I digress, the Mo Williams had a very funny quote when he was announced with Jamario Moon to the Los Angeles media. I appreciate the Clippers for keeping my marriage together, was the quote. And it was because apparently his wife despised Cleveland. So that was very funny as well. So I'm just going to just wanted to throw those in there.
No, we're all there with Mrs. Moon, right? I mean, we can all see what she's seeing.
Yes. And so moving on to a couple other terrible trades, or I should say decisions that just they coincidentally happened to be trades. Kawhi Leonard, I have him down here. I have him involved in two bad decisions. And I guess the first one is just how he entered the league, where the Pacers trade the 15th overall pick, which was Kawhi, to the San Antonio Spurs for George Hill. Who was a 20...
Yeah, so that's a perfect example of what I was talking about, where there was a logic behind what they were doing. They got a benefit. They extracted a benefit from having George Hill with that group. They needed that position filled. They were ready to win kind of at that moment. You know, it didn't look terrible for the first couple of years. But then as history snowballed, Indiana looked like it got definitely a short end of the stick.
Yeah, after Kawhi's first finals MVP, I think they were having buyer's remorse there, or trader's remorse, whatever you want to call it. But like Larry Bird, who was making the decisions at the time for Indiana, said repeatedly that he wanted to acquire veterans who could impact the team right away. But they were also kind of like... They weren't rebuilding at the time, but they just drafted Paul George. They went on to sign David West, I believe, a couple months later. So they were like trying to win. It was clear. And so I understand that. But it was just like, why did you really have to go that route? And real quick, I just want to mention a headline from a local indie paper when the trade was announced. Pacers trade drafted player to San Antonio for former IUPUI star George Hill. And obviously, the drafted player was Kawhi Leonard. Very funny.
That's like when you forget to update the headline before you hit publish. You know, you just have like the block text in there, just like saving your spot. Yeah, that's pretty rough. Again, though, Michael, this wasn't even the worst trade involving Kawhi Leonard.
No, it wasn't. And before I go to that other one, a lot of people don't know, but Davis Bertans was involved in this trade as well. So the Pacers lost. Davis Bertans, who they drafted. I guess the Spurs would have taken that pick and made the selection, but still, like, Davis Bertans, who's now about to get just a boatload of money, and he's one of the best shooters in the world. It's just a real gut punch for the Pacers organization.
Yeah, that's just insult to injury. But, I mean, look, bottom line, the Kawhi trade that really matters was the one that turned the Raptors from a playoff laughingstock into the world champions. DeMar DeRozan, money was involved. San Antonio seemed like they thought their back was against the wall. They were trying to get out in front of a possible, you know, departure in free agency. The terms coming back to San Antonio never really made that much sense. It seemed like they were trying to prioritize respectability and, you know, keeping a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge happy maybe, rather than, you know, heading towards a rebuild. Maybe it was just that they wanted to try to maintain a winning culture and then just figure it out down the road. Whatever it was, I mean, this trade to me, it looks worse month by month the further you go, even though Toronto only got a year out of Kawhi.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an obvious win for the Raptors, and I, like, won't stand for any argument. I mean, the whole point is to win the title, and they won the title, so even though he leaves to go to Los Angeles, and you knew before you made the trade, you know, and talking to anyone around the league, everybody knew he was going to sign with either the Clippers or the Lakers. He was going to Los Angeles. Masai Ujiri obviously did not care, and it paid off, and that's why he's a total stud. I was kind of confused in the moment. I mean, we all didn't know what Kawhi Leonard would look like physically. He basically missed the previous season with this mysterious thigh injury off and on. And I mean, that gave us the dawn of load management to a true superstar that we're in right now in that era of just uncertainty night to night. But like to extract like DeMar DeRozan and Jakob Poeltl and a top 20 protected first round pick, I never really understood it. You kind of laid out the rationale from the Spurs perspective really well, I thought. And I think Greg Popovich did not want to take a step back, understandably. And they already have LaMarcus Aldridge, and you want to win right away. But at the same time, like, if you're going to make a trade like this, you got to get OG Anunoby. You got to get Pascal Siakam. You got to get someone who's a blue chipper. And there was never that possibility in this package.
Yeah, it just seemed like they tried to talk themselves into DeRozan, just like the Raptors fans that tried to talk themselves into DeRozan. They just wanted it to happen, and that's just not quite who he is. I think that they've been really tough to watch these last couple of years, you know, because it does feel like they're just buying time and waiting for their next chapter, and it never really made sense. Michael, I have an outside-the-box thought, though. I'm not even sure this is the best trade that Masai Ujiri made. I think that it's possible.
Okay.
I think it's possible that the Andrea Bargnani trade with the Knicks is actually better than the Kawhi Leonard trade with the San Antonio Spurs. So just to recap.
Yes.
New York traded Marcus Camby, Steve Novak, Quinnen Richardson, a 2016 first-round pick, and two second-round picks for Andrea Bargnani. And I cannot stress this enough for our younger listeners. Bargnani was unbelievably bad at basketball. I mean, just absolutely horrible at basketball. Now, he had some box score stats. He had a few skills here and there. But by this point of his career, all the advanced stats had revealed him to be like basically actively damaging to his teams, because he was arguably the worst defensive player in the entire league who was like playing lots of minutes. And he also was kind of a finesse offensive player who couldn't hit three-pointers, right? So he was taking all the wrong kinds of shots. He wasn't super efficient. He took a lot of shots because he had been a number one overall pick, so he felt kind of emboldened to take a lot of those shots. But he was just one of those guys where, like, okay, you know, he might average 20 points in a season, but, like, you know, the real plus minus or the on-court, off-court, all that kind of stuff just says you don't want this guy on the court if you're trying to win basketball games. And so it seemed like at that point he was going to be sort of a salary dump. At least that's what you would have expected. And instead, New York gives all these draft picks trying to talk themselves that he's going to be like the X factor to push them over the hump. The deal made literally no sense. Like, my head spun when they did it. I couldn't believe it. I'm sure I gave Masai an A+ on the terms. I can't remember exactly. And ultimately, like, New York, it was a pretty straight crash down. I think they got, I'm looking right now at his box line, they got two seasons out of him. Basically, you know, 13 points, 5 rebounds. I mean, just really rough to watch. And part of the problem was just like his commitment and his heart, you know. Does this guy really want to play? You know, you hear all these players, oh, the Mecca of basketball, Madison Square Garden, I can't wait to go play there. I mean, Bargnani, it just kind of felt like the exact opposite of that. It's like, oh God, I got to go play in front of Spike again tonight. I hope everybody doesn't realize how bad I am. I don't know. It just, the whole experience was tough.
The Bargnani New York Knicks experience can be summed up in one of my all-time favorite GIFs, where he tries to basically take off from the free throw line and dunk on I forget who, and instead just falls about 20 feet short and gets called for a charge, and it is just so comical. I mean, the guy is, I mean, there are a lot of, you talk to like several of his former coaches, like his heart was just never in it, and had a lot of talent. It's not easy being a number one overall pick, but it was a tragic move for sure.
Okay, gun to your head, Bargnani trade or Kawhi trade? Which was the worst decision? The Spurs Kawhi trade or the Knicks Bargnani trade?
You know, maybe this is just recency bias, but I just have a really hard time coming to terms with what the Spurs got back when you trade someone who's supposed to be your franchise player for the next 6, 7, 8, 9 years, and you don't get back someone or an asset that can give you some semblance of that production. So I got to go with that move. And honestly, like, you look at what Brandon Ingram has become, and I know that they didn't want to move Kawhi to the Lakers for a variety of reasons, but if you get someone like Ingram, at least you have a new franchise player that you can build around, and they just didn't get anything like that. So I got to go with that move.
I feel you. I was being a little hot takey with the other one. I mean, the stakes are so much higher when you're getting a Finals MVP and a guy who takes down like multiple major rivals. Yeah. But we do need to show a lot of respect. I actually think, should they give Masai another ring for the Bargnani trade? Would that be out of line? Just give him like matching rings, one for each hand. All right, what else do you got, Michael?
I mean, I feel like right now might be a good time to just mention the Harden trade. Right? Like, we've both probably talked about this and written about this ad nauseum over the past 7 or 8 years since it happened. Do you have any thoughts on, why it was bad?
Well, it was another one where I actually defended it at the time more than most people. I thought the logic of the return package was well constructed. I mean, you know, replacing some of what Harden did with Kevin Martin's skill set, with banking, the future draft picks. To me, I just put myself in Sam Presti's position and was like, well, if ownership tells you just can't spend the money that you need to spend, and you realize Harden's going to be a major, major star who's not going to be comfortable in the role that he works best in for your organization, there is some logic behind trading him. But, you know, ultimately, like, it didn't quite pan out. Had they won the title with Kevin Martin there that season, I think people would give them much more of a pass for that trade. I do think there's been a little bit of a pile-on effect for them. But I think all the criticism goes towards ownership's decision not to pay Harden rather than the trade itself. So if the worst decision of the decade was getting cheap on James Harden in Oklahoma City, I think that absolutely deserves to be on the list.
What, can I ask you, what did you think that James Harden was at the time and could be? Did you, like, how good did you think he would, obviously he's going to go to the Hall of Fame. Like, was that even in your mind at all as a possibility? Or, like, just where were you with him?
I could see regular All-Star. Just because of how good he was with the ball in his hands and like just the burst scoring that he could show at times. But you know, the minutes that he got his first couple of seasons, like he was not playing that much. So I think that people remember like his first breakout week in Houston of being like, oh my God, look at this guy. Because remember, he just like scored like, I don't know, 30, 40 points like right out of the gate. And I think everybody hopped on this idea, oh yeah, he's going to be a perennial all-star down the road. But even a couple of years into his Houston tenure, I wasn't convinced he was going to be an MVP level player necessarily. I mean, there was just so many other guys in that same age range who were so good. Mm-hmm. He was really bad defensively. I remember talking to opposing coaches who just like, I mean, they gleamed when they could talk about picking on him during postseason matchups. I know the Blazers at one point ran the same play 4 times in a row and got 4 layups. in a playoff game, if I'm not mistaken, by picking on James Harden. Maybe that's like a late season game before the playoffs. But, you know, needless to say, I mean, this guy was just in a different spot earlier in his career. But you could see the All-Star potential. I mean, he was taken very high in the draft order. He had a very rare combination of ball handling, shooting, and shot creation. I mean, those skills are very valuable. But also, we learned that as the NBA evolved, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years after that trade, his particular skills became even more valuable relative to all the other kinds of skills out there, right?
Right, and I think obviously his organization and the team he ended up on helped facilitate that. And I just remember seeing him pass kind of as like the back, I guess it was like their backup primary ball handler in 2012, I guess it would be. And I mean, that conference finals against the Spurs was just incredible. And I thought his greatest attribute was as a playmaker and just a creative like genius with the basketball. So I didn't foresee necessarily him being this guy who could average 37 a night. But yeah, he was, I recognized that it was a mistake in the moment and just a huge boon for the Houston Rockets. Shall I bless you with another one, Ben?
Yes, but I'm getting a little bit nervous. We've gone for almost an hour, and I don't think there's been a single mention of Vlade Divac. Can you address that, or should I?
Why don't you go ahead right now?
I mean, there's a lot to pick from. I mean, the funniest decision would probably be the Papayannis pick. I just remember everyone falling out of their chairs when I think I was doing a live show when he made that pick. Maybe a draft commentary show. Everybody's scrambling to like look up who this guy is or where is he on other people's boards. Some people really haven't heard of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like a very disorienting moment. I think the one that people look back to was probably the Stauskas trade, where basically the Kings get almost nothing in return and trade out Carl Landry, Nick Stauskas, Jason Thompson, and they part with an unprotected first round pick and a pick swap just to kind of clear cap space. And then I believe they went on to spend that cap space on Rajon Rondo, who, like, at that point, I was already 1,000% out on Rondo.
Your mistake.
Bellinelli. No, not at all. Come on. Bellinelli, who, you know, he is who he is, but he's not going to change a losing program. You know, he's just not that guy. And then Kostas Koufos, where they already had some, like, you know, interior, you know, there wasn't a ton of minutes for him available at that time. Just a perplexing move. It was one of those things where you wondered if someone had ever explained the rules of trades to Vlade before he made it, like if, or he just got completely talked into it, suckered into it. I know the Sixers fans, you know, really celebrated this like their Super Bowl for a couple years. But I think in hindsight, in terms of just like pure asset management and strategic planning and everything else, that's a pretty rough one.
That is an all-timer. That is like a just 101, you do not trade unprotected draft picks to clear cap space lesson, I guess. And yeah, it was, I remember it was just like laughable in the moment and so perplexing. Yeah, Vlade, we could have done a whole Vlade episode, to be honest. So that's why I cut him some slack and I didn't really invest too much time in my research on him and just the legendary moves that he has made with the Sacramento Kings.
Hey, in hindsight and in defense of him, did he wind up actually winning the DeMarcus Cousins trade? So I'm looking at these terms right now. DeMarcus Cousins and Omri Caspi for Buddy Hield, Tyreek Evans, Langston Galloway, a 2017 first-round pick, and a 2017 second-round pick. Now, granted, he basically squandered all of the picks. Langston Galloway, whatever, Tyreek Evans, you know, he wasn't there for very long. But he did get Buddy Hield out of it,
right?
And the right to pay Buddy Hield's current contract. I guess the question is, do you even want to pay Buddy Hield? Because otherwise you could just argue that, you know, if Cousins winds up being almost like negative value after that trade because of all the injuries, I don't know. Maybe they dodged a bullet by not having to pay Cousins and then walked right into another bullet and having to pay Buddy Hield. I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems like they may be one at that.
Well, I mean, they paid Buddy Hield and now they'll probably have to trade him, I think, at some point because they want to pay Bogdan Bogdanovic. We should also mention that he didn't draft Luka, which is probably, that's got to be number one with a bullet here with his mistakes, right?
So I was going to ask you that. That's a great one. It is, what's worse, taking Ayton over Luka or Bagley over Luka?
That's a really good question.
Because it's or trading Trey for Luka. I mean, that's you could also do that one because Luka's definitely.
I can't include Trey there just because I think Trey is such a stud and Atlanta. You know, they got a pick for that. We'll see what happens with Cam Reddish and whatever. Like, I think that is fine. I'm okay with that one. If I was a Hawks fan, I wouldn't cry myself to sleep every night. If I was a Suns fan, I'm still in pretty good shape. If I'm like a Kings fan and I'm thinking about it, like De'Aaron Fox and Luka Doncic on the same team, I just would love to see how that looked and give that a chance for a few seasons. And maybe it doesn't work, and maybe you got to trade one of them, and that would mean you trade De'Aaron Fox, and you're going to get a boatload for him because he's incredible. But like, you got to take the best player available, and that was so obviously Luka Doncic.
That's what I'm saying, Michael. It's not about, oh, I want to see what it looks like. Do you want, you know what I want to see? 77 in front of my home crowd. That's what I want to see. Luka Doncic. I mean, look what he's doing to Dallas, turning them around, got their fan base engaged.
Yeah.
I mean, you're selling him to every single season ticket holder. He's on every little promotional item, his face, his jerseys everywhere in Dallas. I mean, it's just a no-brainer. I mean, franchises kill to get those kinds of franchise-level talents. They're basically impossible to get. They had one staring right at them, and it doesn't even seem like they really considered it that much. Originally, I kind of faulted Phoenix more for taking Ayton, in part because they had Luka's coach, and it's like, come on, bro. Like, he should be able to tell you exactly how good Luka's going to be, and if you're going to just go with the hometown guy over the perfect fit for your coach, then I don't know what to tell you. That seems like bad organization. But the longer that I think about it, I mean, these decisions should get easier the further down the board you go, because the talent is getting worse the further you go. And for Sacramento to need a franchise player forever, to realize what happens if you get kind of the wrong franchise player in Cousins, and here's Luka staring right at you, and you go a different direction for another big after like 7 years of bigs who haven't worked out for you in the lottery, I think that one's worse. You're right.
Yeah, this is really getting depressing.
No, this is why we do it. This is for the love of the game. For the hate of the decisions, for the love of the game, Michael. Keep them coming.
Okay, so this one is just really personal, and I'm going to guarantee that no one else has it on their worst decisions big board. I've said it before, and I've felt it in my heart ever since. This is Boston Celtics related, if I wasn't telegraphing that enough. The Celtics' decision to draft Kelly Olynyk instead of Giannis Antetokounmpo, I just don't think I'll ever, like, I'll never just understand or get over it. And for those who aren't really aware of the entire backstory, the Celtics had just traded Doc Rivers to the Los Angeles Clippers for a first-round pick. They just hired Brad Stevens, or were about to hire him. They were rebuilding. They knew they were going to be bad for the foreseeable future. They traded up to get Kelly Olynyk, the 13th overall pick. You knew that Kelly Olynyk, who I think was 22 when they drafted him, you knew what the ceiling was. You knew the skill set. You knew he was going to be a big who could shoot, and that was really valuable. And he was super efficient at Gonzaga. But at the same time, you knew that there was a ceiling. You knew defensively there were warts. You knew that the league was changing. And, you know, if you wanted to go small, what was his role going to be? And so if you're, like, just fundamentally as a philosophy in drafting, I'm not saying they should have known, the Celtics should have known that Giannis was going to be a multiple-time MVP and this transcendent phenom who would kind of revolutionize basketball in his own way. But you know that he's just really unquantifiable, and you know that physically he's going to be something different, and you don't really even know how to project what he's going to be. So, like, just why not take a flyer on him? It really, if you look at it from that perspective, it never really made a ton of sense to me. Am I, like, being too harsh here? Because a lot of other teams passed on Giannis as well. He was taken 15th overall. But, like, I just feel like, philosophically, the Boston Celtics should have been aligned with taking a player like that.
Well, it's so interesting because, like, Danny just, like, sweated KD, right? And, like, so much of what he loved about KD was kind of the form breaking, you know, score. Like, he's so long, he's this incredible scorer, but also just like the dedication to the sport. I mean, like, everybody knows Danny's this crazy competitor, multiple sport athlete coming up as a high school player and everything else. And it's like, of all the traits that KD and Giannis share, certainly personal weight training program would probably not be on that list, right? I mean, Giannis is a little bit more jacked, I would say, but the utter devotion to the game, right? And just like you know, willing to try to improve, constantly be in the gym. I mean, the story is about KD always sleeping at the Sleep Pleasant Recreation Center in between games so he could play more often, didn't have to go home to sleep. And Giannis working his way up through, you know, the Greek minor leagues and just like, you know, being completely obsessed with trying to get better. That's the trait they shared. It's the exact trait you think would like magnetize Danny Ainge to Giannis. And it just, it didn't play out that way. But Michael, I mean, this is not even close to the worst decision in that famed 2013 draft, Michael. And we don't have to go past the number one spot to find it.
No, we don't.
Did the Cleveland Cavaliers think that Anthony Bennett was Zion Williamson? Is that what happened? Is that what they were expecting when they drafted that number one pick of just like this big, athletic, you know, the next Larry Johnson, the next Charles Barkley? Like, what was their vision? Because I'm looking right now on career win shares, and we were talking about like, I mean, if you want to talk about Bargnani level advanced stats and like love for the game, do you remember the clips that would circulate of Anthony Bennett just like wandering around during the half court offense, like not even paying attention to the game that was going on? It was almost like he was holding a one man like protest or like strike during the game. That happened when he was in Cleveland, but his career win share is 0.5 cumulative career win shares. And if you guys aren't stat nerds, just realize Giannis has 63 of them. So he's 126 times better than the number one pick in that draft. And if you're also saying, okay, well, where does that fare? There was 51 players selected in that draft who've played at least one NBA minute. Anthony Bennett ranks 39th in career win shares out of the 51. And there's only one other guy taken in the first round, the 30th pick, Nemanja Nedović, who has fewer career win shares than Anthony Bennett. So basically, anyone else taken with the first 29 picks would have been an improvement over Anthony Bennett. That's really hard to do, barring a crazy career-altering injury, to get that pick that bad. I mean, that's in the conversation for the worst draft pick ever and the worst decision of the decade, isn't
it? Really bad. Yeah. I mean, it's an all-time bust. Oladipo goes next. He becomes this all-star, all-NBA player.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to start reading some of the players in this draft who have more career win shares than Anthony Bennett, geez. Okay? And we're going to see how many you can make it through without laughing, okay? Archie Goodwin. Ray McCallum.
Okay, yeah, I'm done. I can't.
Ryan Kelly, Isaiah Kanan, Shane Larkin. Wasn't he a Celtics legend at one point?
Oh, legend, yeah.
Bebe Naguera, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Another Portland Hall of Famer, Jeff Withey. Actually, I think they traded him. Michael Carter Williams, Shabazz Muhammad. Haven't heard that name in a while. I mean, the list goes on and on. Mike Muscala is blowing him out of the water. I mean, Tony Snell looks like a freaking all-star compared to our guy Anthony Bennett. Worst decision of the decade. Was that the one?
That's not worst for me. Well, I mean, like, do you remember right before this draft how, like, down on it everybody was? I mean, there are some really interesting names that have come from it.
Oh, rightfully so. I mean, look, number three, Otto Porter. Number four, Cody Zeller. Number five, Alex Len.
It's another so home bad, run. Yeah.
Another home run from Phoenix. Number six, Nerlens Noel. Number seven, Ben McLemore. Number eight, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Number nine, Trey Burke. I mean, all those guys, I don't know if you want to call them busts, but they're not, none of those guys are great, you know, and certainly like for Otto Porter, when you factor in his contract, that's pretty rough. I don't know if that excuses you for taking Anthony Bennett. People thought Anthony Bennett was going to be like 8-12, right?
Yeah. I mean, they swung and they missed really bad. And I mean, this is an organization that was really like lost in the wilderness at the time. And it's really amazing that they made this pick and still were able to lure LeBron back. And I don't want to put my tinfoil hat on here, but they won several lotteries from when LeBron left to when he returned. And it's pretty intriguing. But yeah, this is an all-time terrible pick for sure. It honestly didn't even really, maybe it's just because it's so like known and like, I don't know. It just didn't really register with me when I was kind of putting my list together.
I think that it's been talked about so much that you're like vaccinated against
too
it.
Too obvious. Right?
You've built up your NBA Twitter brain antibodies, and then you don't even like think about it. But I don't think we should undersell that one. That one is really, really bad. I mean, another one you pointed out, the next draft, you've mentioned this one before to me, mm-hmm. is taking Jabari Parker over Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. Very defensible at the time, no doubt. They had lots of reasons to do with the local angle and everything else. But that one also winds up being horrible from Milwaukee's perspective. All right, do you have any other honorable mentions or just final ones you want to get off your chest before we close this thing up, Michael?
So I have one more that I've been saving just to have a brief little conversation with you about that is pretty philosophical, I think. And these are two decisions I personally think are bad, and I think you think that they're not bad. So they are, I'll just kind of bundle them together. They're Kevin Durant's decision to sign with the Warriors and Kevin Durant's decision to leave the Warriors and team up with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. And I know that those are two very separate things, and the circumstances are obviously different for a variety of reasons, but I just thought that both were bad. And I just, like, for a player who, I mean, he's all-time dozen best players ever, I think, will be where he will stand when it's all said and done. And for him to make these two decisions in his prime, it's just like, I don't know. It's never sat well with me, particularly the first one, going to the Warriors. And it's just getting worse and worse with time, in my opinion.
Very painful. I'm scrambling. I'm like trying to like distract you off the scent. Like, what about when the Kings took Jimmer over Clay? Like, I'm like coming up with like other ones that I could throw out there. What about when the Minnesota Timberwolves drafted a guy who was like 5 years too old and Targay Ngombo? Remember that? Another great hit from David Kahn. Well, here's the deal. I look at these two decisions very distinctly. Okay. I do not like, and never liked, from the moment it happened, the Brooklyn Nets decision. I thought he just picked the wrong guy to team up with. I thought he picked the wrong franchise as a platform. I thought he picked the wrong timing and execution of how the whole thing rolled out. I basically disagreed with it every single step of the way. And to be clear, I support every player's right to do what they want. If that's what's going to make him happy, to play buddy ball with his guys in Brooklyn, go for it. But I just do not co-sign. I'm so skeptical of it. I doubt they're going to make any meaningful noise in the playoffs with that group together. And this season, the franchise was just in shambles, right on schedule. So that one, I'm going to grant you. The Golden State one, will history look back on it with a little bit less skepticism? He got the two finals MVPs. He got the two titles. He played on a team that was arguably the greatest collection of talent in NBA history. Their run through the 2017 to the finals and then through the title is only, you know, kind of forgotten or, in my view, undervalued because they broke the sport and broke everyone's, you know, there was no competitive interest because they were just too good for everyone that they played. Yes. And to a certain degree, I give those guys credit for that. Mm. Like, it's good to master your craft. Mm. I know other people don't agree.
I don't agree.
But I will always stand up. Yeah, I know. Well, haters never do. Look, it was the ideal way that I wanted his first title to play out as a guy who was kind of tracking his every movement throughout his career. Not exactly. Were those teams a lot of fun to cover and to watch for me personally? Yes. Are they going to resonate with a wider audience, you know, years and years down the road? Probably not. And did he change his narrative in a way that could wind up being like a net negative for him through that decision? I can hear your argument on that one as well. But ultimately, like, what I believe in is the titles, the rings, the validation, you know, the chase for greatness. And at least his decision, the first one in 2016, set him on that path. So I will always defend it.
I hate what this did to the NBA as a competitive enterprise. And people get so lost defending KD's right to choose his destination without understanding that you can acknowledge that right and still criticize the choice he made, which is kind of where I stand on it. And I just kind of view both of these choices as misreads that were partly born from, I mean, like, a particular insecurity and lacking self-awareness on Kevin Durant's part. And going to the Golden State Warriors, knowing like the expectations that he had for himself going there and how it would change how people perceived him, despite the fact that he's leaving the team that just lost to the Golden State Warriors in a classic Western Conference Finals. And I mean, it's just like, it's incredible to look back on it and try to like figure out what exactly he's thinking. And at the time, he's talking about how he wants to be happy and play this certain style and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, in hindsight, we know that either that's not what he wanted or he never knew what he wanted, because a few years later, he leaves. So it's like, I don't know. I can't come to terms with it. I think in, like, maybe 30, 40, 50 years, you'll just look at Basketball Reference, if that still exists, and see that he won two finals MVPs and he put up these ridiculous numbers, and you'll think, wow, he was incredible. And but you, if you live through it like we did, and you kind of knew all the context, it just doesn't hold the same weight for me.
Well, I'll say this. He didn't know what he really wanted. I think that definitely bore out like you're describing. And I actually think his second decision makes the first one worse. If he had been able to extend the run in Golden State and had just kind of continued to stack up the accolades, the finals MVPs, the titles.
I agree with this.
Kind of keep that thing going. Eventually, he could sort of outlast the haters, right? But I think there was still enough, backlash at the point when he was, starting to make moves towards wanting out, and then he became the bad guy in his final year because he was the one snipping at the media, because he was the one distanced from his teammates. He's the one who's having his loyalty questioned by Draymond Green in the famous blow up. And then ultimately, through no fault of his own, he's the guy who ended up getting injured. And that injury was the difference between them winning the title or not, period. You know, they win the title if he's healthy. So I think for all of that, it winds up being a really sad story. If he had gone back and just kind of doubled down and said, you know what, I hear all the criticism from the outside, but this is who I wanted to be. I had clear reasons for, choosing to go to Golden State in the first place, and I'm delivering on them. I think he could have slowly tried to, win people over, or at least, outlast them. I do remember, last year's playoffs in the first round, where he's putting up 50 points on the Clippers, people were starting to come around to this idea, mm-hmm. Okay, we have to crown him. Yep. He's the best player in the sport. LeBron's on the sidelines. Like, this is his time to shine, and he just never got that validating moment. And I feel rough for him, and I really don't think it's coming in Brooklyn, unfortunately. I don't like the setup, the structure, and any of it. And so I think it winds up turning that injury into one of the ultimate basketball tragedies for a lot of reasons. It's a shame. YouTube is going to treat KD very, very kindly. People are going to look back in 20, 30 years and be like, oh my God, look what this guy could do. He was a bucket, as they like to say on NBA Twitter. All right, Michael, I think we've come to the end of another episode of Open Floor. I'm sure we got at least 10 poor decisions mentioned along the way, but guess what? We need the Open Floor Globe to chime in with their own favorite worst decisions of the last decade. I know somebody over the weekend, just out of the blue, Michael mentioned the Orlando Magic's trade for Serge Ibaka as like the trade that just gnaws at them because they could have had Victor Oladipo's prime.
That's a great one.
I'm sure your own team has a move over the last 10 years that drives you crazy or makes you elated with how you were able to fleece the other team. Let us know about it. We'd love to hear it. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. Michael and I will double back later this week to take your questions, to check in on the NBA's return plans with teams finally headed down to Orlando to get themselves inside that bubble. So keep all those questions, comments, and quips coming our way. Check us out on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Check out my Washington Post newsletter on the decision 10 years later this week and a whole bunch of other stories coming. WashingtonPost.com/sports. All right, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, man.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Mess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.